Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Do public schools deliver what states and communities are paying for? Nationally, kids spend as much as 25% of their school time taking or prepping for tests designed to measure how well their teachers, schools, and districts are serving them at a cost of more than $1.7 billion a year. Texas students now contribute less to those figures after the Texas Education Agency cut the number of standardized tests from 15 to 5, and state lawmakers are considering additional cuts. But my guest would remind us that the goal of knowing what students are really learning arose from widespread agreement that publicly funded schools should be required to demonstrate their value to communities and strive to give all students the same opportunities regardless of their socioeconomic backgrounds. William McKenzie is editorial director of the George W. Bush Institute. His essay, The Big Idea of School Accountability, is available online at bushcenter.org. Bill, welcome back to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Good to be here.
All right, let's start with this. What is the relationship between racial integration of public education and the demand for some kind of objective measures of performance?
Well, I think they go hand in hand. And as we try to point out in this essay, when this idea of this big idea of school accountability, as we call it, it started, the germ of the idea started with Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s. So we came out of Brown versus the Board in 54, saying we're no longer going to have separate and unequal schools. We're going to try now. Johnson was saying 10 years later that we're no longer going to tolerate these gaps in achievement, and we're really going to try to make this idea a reality. And so it wasn't at that time that all of a sudden we had annual independent statewide tests. That didn't happen for a good while. But in the mid-1960s, you had people like Bobby Kennedy who were questioning, well, how well are we going to know if schools are doing? And in this essay, we bring up some research or a quote from Bobby Kennedy, which I'll read here because I really thought it was fascinating. He goes, I think it is – this is Bobby Kennedy speaking at a hearing in 1965. I think it is very difficult for a person who lives in a community to know whether, in fact, his educational system is what it should be. Whether if you compare his community to a neighboring community, they are doing everything they should be. Whether the people that are operating the educational system in the state or local community are as good as they should be. I wonder if we couldn't have some system of reporting through some testing system that would be established, which the people, local community, would know periodically what progress had been made. So this is 1965. Shortly after that, the National Assessment of Educational Progress was born, and it came out of folks who were involved in the war on poverty for this very reason Kennedy was talking about. Is there a way to know what students are learning?
So we had the National Assessment for Educational Progress, but there were districts, including, as you report, DISD, that said, okay, we'll only give this to certain students
initially. Well, in NAEP, as it is called, there are a lot of acronyms in education, too many, but there are a lot of
education in the military.
Exactly. So NAEP was voluntary, and so what was happening in DISD was the Iowa Basic Skills Test, which is what I grew up taking in Fort Worth, was not required. DISD didn't require it to be given at all schools, and all schools meant a large number of students that have African American students. And so that was just one example of what we, President Bush later came to call kind of the soft bigotry of low expectations. They weren't testing some of these students, so they wouldn't really know where they are, how they're performing on a test that is given across many other districts.
When the Nation at Risk report came out in 1983, talk a little bit about the effect that had. And I gather I was still quite young at the time, but it was kind of a slap in the face for people who were, concerned with the progress we were making as a nation.
Right. So it comes out, and Secretary Bell was the Secretary of Education under Ronald Reagan, and he convened these task forces to look and to see how the U.S. was doing as the economy was then becoming globalized. I mean, we think of it being global today. Well, the germ of that was just starting in the late 70s, early 80s. And what they found was that there really were some significant gaps when you looked at us versus nations around the world. And I was living in D.C. at the time. It was a big deal, you know, when it came out. And President Reagan went around and talked about it after the report came about, gave a number of speeches about it. So, you know, it was another movement along this arc, I guess you would say, started with Johnson, included Bobby Kennedy. It moves through the 70s. In the 80s, you have President Reagan and others talking about we need to increase our standards, raise our standards. We need to know what students, if they're meeting these standards and what we need to do to try to improve that.
Critics of that report, of course, have said for a long time that some of the apparent decline in performance had to do with the fact that more students overall were being tested than ever before.
Probably true. So we have more students. The student body is changing. The demographics of the country were starting to change. And as we know now, they've changed even more so, which I think is why these ideas that are encapsulated in school accountability, creating standards, testing students to see if they know those standards, and having some consequences to the results. We can argue what the consequences should be, but it should be some consequence for the school. It matters even more now because of the changing demographics. But to your point, there were more kids being tested. We had, you know, a desegregation had ended. We were integrating schools more. This was good. But we were also having to see, where are we?
What have you learned, Bill, about how expectations are set? Like, how do we decide this is what's appropriate for a third grader to know? This is what's appropriate for an eighth grader to be able to do? And then what the, you know, appropriate incremental progress is.
Right. So that's where your experts come in. I mean, I'm a journalist by training, so I'm not your education researcher. But that is where the people who are either in Washington, the U.S. Department of Education, or in Texas, the Texas Education Agency, that are going to, you know, to use their data and their research to know what would be appropriate. So, you know, in Texas, the State Board of Education sets the standards. They set the standards in math. They set it in history, and they set it in English. You know, oftentimes we're reading the paper, all these controversies that go on with setting the standards. But they set the standards. And then the Texas Education Agency is responsible for trying to see whether these students are meeting these standards. And so they then contract with Pearson is the one that's a big bookaboo, and everybody always goes after Pearson. There are McGraw-Hill. There are others that are out there who also do the testing. They work with the agency. The agency is the one responsible for making sure that the items in there are reflective of what the test should include.
We are in Texas fiercely you know, proud of our independence, and local accountability and local standards are something we really want. We want local curriculum standards. We are notably not a Common Core state. But I'm wondering, having looked at this issue broadly, is the education really very different from one state to the next? I mean, is it vastly different what a student learns in, you know, a school district in Houston as compared to a school district in El Paso or in Fort Worth?
Well, two things here. Are our state standards comparable across states? And the answer is not necessarily always. And that was one of the beauties of No Child Left Behind, was to try to see because states in the 90s were starting to set up their systems of measuring, but not all states had it. So No Child required annual measurement, and that required standards that, you know, they would have to measure against. No, not all states were going to have necessarily comparable standards. You know, for a long time, Massachusetts was the leader. And so along came Texas in the 90s, and Texas and North Carolina really got involved in this. It was bipartisan. The RAND Corporation had a study that came out sometime in the late 90s saying, you know, that what Texas and North Carolina are doing is really important and is a way to determine whether students are learning and meeting those standards. But let me go back to your other question. Is Houston, Dallas, Fort Worth, Austin, whatever it is, this is really important because we need to have some comparability. Yes, I understand we'd all like to think that our schools are good as like our local congressman. We like our local congressman, but we hate Congress.
Right.
So, but the state is the one that charters the schools. The state is the one who puts money in the school. The state has a responsibility to know whether the schools that it is in charge of are meeting the standards. And so, the state does have that responsibility and obligation to make sure for the students' sake they're learning and also for the taxpayers' sake that the money is being invested wisely.
I was really surprised that before No Child Left Behind, and I suppose I should have known this, but that there were a number of states that did no annual standardized assessment whatsoever.
Right. And I should know that figure. I've seen it numerous times. I don't remember. But there were quite a few that didn't. And so this really wasn't this kind of started taking off in the 1990s, that some states were starting to do this, but it was under No Child when it came about. Now, I used to go to governor's conferences when I was at the Dallas Morning News and cover them some. And so in the 90s, you had a lot of governors who would they'd talk about this stuff. So it was kind of taking off then.
And of course, there is the idea that every student should be tested, and that includes students who come in from other countries who are at a socioeconomic disadvantage. But one thing I want to talk about is the fact that big data now can sort of allow us to measure things on a really precise basis according to how students are doing. Is this being done? So in other words, are even though everyone is expected to hold to the same standard, are we comparing students based on like zip code and parental income and language background and that sort of thing?
Sure. I mean, that is one of the beauties of No Child Left Behind, and that's one of the parts that very few people argue about. Is that you have, it's a horrible term, but it's disaggregation of data. Mm-hmm. You break data down according to race, income, gender, other categories, and disabilities, for example. And that way, parents, educators, taxpayers can see, how students in these different categories are performing. It's also one reason today that you see civil rights groups who are concerned about Washington perhaps rolling back on annual testing in grades 3 through 8 and 10. And the other day, Wade Henderson, head of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, wrote a piece in the New York Times. He's testified on the Hill most recently, warning about what could happen if we don't have this kind of data.
What do we do about the fact that, like, income and parental education are so predictive of test scores, and yet most of the solutions we look at are tied to putting more money into the schools, putting resources into the schools. Should we be looking at solutions that are tied to other things related to students' lives outside the classroom, off school campuses entirely?
Right. Well, should we be paying attention to the conditions of poverty that surround the school? Absolutely. There's no question about that. The other question, though, is what can schools do between the hours of, let's say, 8 and 4? And they undoubtedly are going to deal with the effects of poverty. I don't think anybody disputes that. But they also have an opportunity within those hours to try to improve achievement. And that, a lot of things go into that. A lot of things go into better instruction. But you do have a chance within those hours to try to improve it.
My guest is William McKenzie. He's editorial director of the George W. Bush Institute and has a new essay out on the Bush Center website called The Big Idea of School Accountability. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join it, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Bye.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs, accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with William McKenzie of the George W. Bush Institute about his essay, The Big Idea of School Accountability, which is available online at bushcenter.org. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. How did No Pass, No Play affect the way we approached accountability, particularly because it was really that targeted students more than anybody?
Yeah, that kind of jump-started it here in Texas. So that was in 84-5. Ross Perot was the head of the commission that was put together. And Tom Luce, who many know in this community, who through his involvement in education and now with mental health care at the Meadows Institute, was involved in this. And so No Pass, No Play came away out as a way to say, in effect, you know, if your son or daughter is not meeting, meeting standards, then there's not going to be Friday night football for you. And that was, you know, was controversial, not surprisingly. But it kind of jump-started the accountability movement here in Texas. And so Bill Clements later came back in his second term, and he set up a commission to look to see what, you know, our students really needed to learn and know to be part of this technology economy that was rapidly evolving. And that commission kind of helped sow the seeds for what later became an accountability system in the 1990s. But No Pass, No Play was a very big part of a big beginning here with it.
Do their own test scores and results tend to motivate students? Do we know much about how much students themselves are paying attention to whether they pass these state tests?
Right. Now, it would be more the schools that mm-hmm. pay attention. And, you know, they do pay attention. One thing I would say is I think this would be true not only for Texas but for other states. I think we need to keep working on our rating systems because a lot of times they're very hard to fathom. And I think we need to make this more transparent for parents so they can understand if their school gets an X rating, what that really means.
Yeah, you can look on the TEA's websites and you can find data, but I've looked for my own children's schools and they're a little bit challenging to figure out.
Right.
It seems like if we're trying to be transparent and accountable, that would be the first place to go.
Yes, I think that is an area where as we rethink accountability, and a lot of times you'll see this in literature, accountability 2.0 or 3.0, whatever you want to call it, I think that's an area that you know we could see improvement. I think also another area that we could see improvement are benchmark tests. So, you know, people at the playground level will oftentimes complain about there are too many tests. I hear this as a parent. And I think what we get mixed up in our minds are the types of tests we have. So we got the classroom test that, you know, most of us took as kids before there were standardized tests. And there's a lot of science that says those kind of tests that that classroom teachers give are very important, the frequency of it, mm-hmm. Because that helps you learn and grasp that material. But that's different from an annual independent comparable exam that the state gives, which, by the way, is only, you know, once a year. And no child requires it in grades 3 through 8 and 10, reading and math. And so, you know, you have that annual independence test, but what's kind of developed over, you know, the last decade or so, and I don't have the exact time when it started, but benchmark test. So districts will give them. DISD gives them. Houston gives them. Other places give them. And sometimes they do them right. Sometimes they don't do them right. But these can also they add to the frequency of it. Center for American Progress did a report sometime over the last year or so looking at the frequency of benchmark tests. And in some states, you know, they were vastly outnumber the number of the tests that are required through No Child Left Behind. In fact, that figure you read at the opening of the show about whatever percent of time is devoted to tests, well, I would argue a lot of that time are the benchmark tests. And so we need to rethink those and how we use them. There is a high school in Waxahachie, early college high. I was interviewing their principal sometime last year, and he said, I've done away with benchmarks. And I thought, that's interesting. I kind of want to follow up. So, you know, it's a school that is going to attract a certain level of students. And I'm not saying every school can let go of benchmark tests, but he has let go of them. In return, he's in the classroom a lot more. It's a smaller high school, and he's trying to observe the instruction and the teaching. They still take the state test, but he did away with benchmark. Houston has done something a little different. They have a system that if you are qualified as a high-performing high school, which they have a metric that determines that, then you don't have to take the benchmark test. You can if you want to, but you don't have to. But they want the low performers to do it. In Dallas, they have two official benchmarks. That is in January and in the school year. And that's part of what we saw the big hoo-ha about here when Mike Miles had some parents protesting over these benchmark tests being in grades kindergarten through second grade. Personally, I think there is science that shows some of this can really help us grasp early what kids are knowing or not knowing in kindergarten through second grade. But Miles also came back and said, okay, we'll give up some of these benchmark tests. And I think that was probably a smart move, you know, in some ways to do. But, you know, these add to the frequency of test. And I think that is what parents are oftentimes complaining about.
Lots of parents, along with educators, have complained about the need to teach to the test. And I wonder how is teaching to the test different from teaching state standards?
Yeah. Well, this is going to get me a lot of trouble. I don't have a problem at all if somebody is teaching to the test, if their really instruction is really geared to the state standards. Why? That's what they should be doing, because we want them to learn the standards. I think the issue of teaching the test has more to do with whether teachers are they just repeating the same thing over and over again? It's called drill and kill. Don't doubt that goes on. I would argue that perhaps in those situations is what we need is more research at the school level about what effective teaching is really like, because I think you can get there without having to drill and kill.
You have a statistic in the piece that says something like, you know, parents are not satisfied if their students who are, what is it, a year behind, make up half a year over the course of a school year, even if they're making progress. And I gather that school accountability is not satisfied with that. I mean, at what point can you say progress? You know, there are failing schools that are making regular annual progress and continue to be penalized.
Well, two thoughts here. One is that polling data you came from Dave Winston, pollster in D.C., and the figures were right around 60% of minority parents, African-American and Hispanic parents, were saying they didn't consider it good, whatever the phrase was, if their student was a year behind and made up half a grade.
So it was only a half a year behind by the end.
Correct. Mm-hmm. They didn't consider that progress enough, and they didn't consider progress. You know, they wanted them to get the full year made up. And these were African-American and Latino parents. And here, too, this is part of one of, I'd say, the little dirty little secrets of accountability. You find support for this among minority parents and minority leaders who fear that without these sort of systems, their kids get left behind. And I'll give you an example. So I know of a school where, you know, I've sat through meetings there, and the parents and the principal were going over some of the data that we had that had just come out about their ACP scores, what the benchmark test in Dallas. And the scores on reading were like 75% passing in fourth or fifth grade. I forgot which. 75% beats the district average. That's good. But what 75% means in that class, in fourth or fifth grade, 25% of those kids are not passing reading, a fundamental core subject. And if they're not grasping that in the fourth grade, what's going to be like by the eighth grade? So, you know, 75% is good, but we shouldn't cheer that. We shouldn't cheer the fact that a quarter of the kids are being left behind. And so in this school, I happen to know, it was largely Hispanic kids.
So I'll take your point that knowing that students are or are not passing is vital, right, in order to to make sure that we are keeping track of how they go along. What that doesn't do is offer us necessarily a clear path in terms of what to do for those students. What's the relationship between what we learn about students' progress and achievement through testing and what we do to get them where they need to be?
Well, I would say this, that if your school shows up on the STARS test, which is the Texas Annual Independent Exam, and let's say your school is, like the example I just cited, 25% of your kids in fourth grade are not passing reading, and you know from your district exam that that number is pretty comparable, you know you have a problem there. And so if you're really got strong school leadership, that principal will be using that data to try to go in and figure out what strategies can we use specifically in fourth grade to try to improve instruction there. So in DISD, and DISD isn't alone, math has oftentimes been a hard subject. And so Mike Miles, the superintendent, had wanted more instructional coaches in schools to help teachers to improve their strategies in the classroom in a subject like math. So, yeah, that's an example. You aren't going to be able to take that test data and say child X needs Y because it's more at the aggregate, a larger level. It's at the school level. And so, but you can take that data and see if you see consistent patterns over time. We need to address those. And if your school isn't addressing them, then I would say that's most likely going to be a failure of leadership at your school to be able to use that data to go in and intervene. I'm not saying that every time you're going to hit a home run, but if year over year, if you aren't changing something around, that suggests to me that perhaps you don't have the right leadership in the school.
Is there any danger that some of the focus on accountability at the campus level, at even the classroom level, really just tells good teachers that if you want to continue to be rewarded and to be acknowledged for the hard work you're doing, then you want to get yourself into a school where students are wealthy, where parents have resources, where nobody comes in with a language
deficit. Right, and that's where you need incentives. The legislature in Austin has done that, to give incentives to teachers to go into low-performing schools. And I think that's really important. I think you also can measure growth. And so you asked that in the last question. I didn't get to it. Yes, there is, it may not be that every student is getting over the bar, a bar in reading, a bar in math. We want that. But they are making progress towards getting over that bar. And that's good. And we should be glad when we're seeing progress, but eventually we want them over the bar. So I would say to teachers who think, well, I'm going to go to a high-performing school versus low-performing, well, if you go into low-performing school and you're showing that you add value there, that will help your cause when it comes time for your review.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with William in Roanoke. Hi, William.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a couple questions. The first one, if I could ask, is, what has any of the research shown on the international benchmarks as far as how well our children are doing compared to their peers in Shanghai, Helsinki, Warsaw, and Seoul? Those are the examples from a recent book that was published. And then as far as our children being competitive, then the other question is, does it make any sense at all to take a child who cannot read at the fourth grade level and put them in the fifth grade?
Thanks so much for your call, William.
Right. Well, to the first question, I think he's referring to a book Amanda Ripley for the New America Foundation, Time Magazine, wrote called The Smartest Kids in the World, and she looked at Finland, she looked at Poland, and she looked at Korea. So there is a international assessment called PISA, Performance International Student Assessment, whatever it stands for. And so that's kind of the equivalent of the NAEP exams, nationally. And so when you look at where we are on some PISA results, we don't own it the way we probably should. I will say I haven't been involved with it. I got there before I started the Bush Institute. They have a global report card that looks at this very thing to kind of compare how you're not your individual school, but your district may be doing using a variety of data compared to other places around the world. And so what you see is, in short, is yes, we have been making some progress in some areas over time, but when it comes to where we are compared to a number of other countries in what's called the an international setting, you know, we could be doing a lot better.
I realize this costs huge amounts of money, but is anybody talking about looking at distant outcomes long after students have left the 12th grade? You know, comparing test results at particular points in their academic lives with, you know, at 25, 28, 30, where they are in the community, how much they're able to earn, what kind of work they're doing.
Right. So I think the way I'll answer that question is, yes, we do know that if students are not going to finish high school, let's say, and this is pretty logical and the data shows it, they are not going to be able to have the same income as people who finish high school and go on to college. So we know that. There's going to be a difference there. What we do know is that quality teachers, students are exposed to quality education year over year. There have been studies that show that that is going to increase their economic viability by X amount, whatever it is. I don't recall it off the top of my head. So, yes, there is a correlation that what happens in K through 12 is going to impact what you will be earning once you get out.
We're speaking this hour with William McKenzie. He's editorial director of the George W. Bush Institute. He recently published an essay online at bushcenter.org. It's called The Big Idea of School Accountability. Welcome back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs, accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the editorial director of the George W. Bush Institute, William McKenzie, whose essay, The Big Idea of School Accountability, is online now at bushcenter.org. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can join us there. Let's speak with Tony in DeSoto. Hey, Tony.
Good morning. Good evening. How y'all doing?
Good. Thanks.
All right. My question is that, usually when you bring people like this on the show, they always come with studies and numbers. But my issue would be that if kids saw themselves in minority kids saw themselves in the books they read, they would read more. And it seems as though we try to get around this by saying, well, they read quality books. No, minority kids need to see themselves in the stories that they read. My son is black, 8 years old. I find books to see himself in America's fabric. A good example is this. Christopher Attucks was one of the first black people to die in the American Revolution. He was a black man. Very few people know that. And the reality is that we're always trying to talk about minority kids, compare them with suburbs, but compare the same number of minority kids in the cities to the Appalachian numbers, I guarantee you they're probably the same when it comes to education levels.
Tony, thank you so much for your call. And I think he brought up something really interesting, Bill, which is the idea that You know, part of this puzzle of student achievement is students feeling really engaged in school and feeling like what they are learning is relevant to their lives.
Right. And no question. And I think there's also, and I'm not an expert in this area of research, but I have seen some research that, will show that, you know, perhaps a minority student having a minority teacher in there with them can have a beneficial effect. So I think to the caller's point there, there's some truth to what he's saying. A lot of this, of course, does depend on effective teaching, engaged teaching. And that's why it's so very important, to make sure that our colleges of education are turning out, attracting, I hate this term, but the best and brightest, but to attract innovative students who want to go into teaching. That will really make a difference at the classroom level.
What should we do for schools that are sort of firing on all cylinders and demonstrating progress? We talk a lot about what we need to do about the ones that aren't doing well, but how do you continue to motivate campuses that are achieving?
Right. And that's a good point. I don't think you exempt them from the accountability system. Some have argued for that in Texas in previous legislatures, and I don't think that is the answer. I think there it gets back into the quality of leadership you have at the school. So if you have kids who feel like they need to be challenged beyond the state standards, then, you have the time and opportunity to go do this. I would say, the tests that are given here in Texas, it's a floor test. It isn't measuring everything necessarily, but it's wanting to make sure that the floor level we're getting the basics done. That doesn't mean that you can't add that in other elements in your classroom.
It is, by and large, private companies that contract with states to create these tests. There have been reports from some of those companies that particular states have come to them and asked to adjust the tests. And the question is, are they adjusting them to make them more appropriate and to make them more accurate, or are they adjusting them to make them easier to pass?
Right. Well, you'd have to ask the test people, the test makers that, because I don't know the answer to what they're doing. It could be both, but the state agency in Texas, the Texas Education Agency, they're the ones on the hook for this. They're the ones who do the contract. They're the ones, and the company Pearson, it's going to have teachers who are reviewing these items that are tested. So it isn't that we necessarily have people in these private companies that are calling all the shots. You have educators who are participating in this, and these companies do have to meet certain standards of standardized tests that groups like the American Psychological Association and others have set for what makes a quality standardized test.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Michael in Dallas. Hello, Michael.
Hi, I'm Michael, and I was an elementary music teacher for 16 years in public school, and I'm a PhD student now in music education. One of the things I would love to hear your guest address is, a lot of times in low-performing schools, behavior expectations are much lower, and a lot of times emotionally disturbed children or other children who are in the classroom are disrupting learning, and sometimes it takes weeks, if not months, of documenting behavior before those children are in better situations for their learning, but the other students are also, their learning is suffering during that time as well. And I wonder if you have any ideas about teachers who may not want to go into low-performing schools, that sometimes it's because of behavior expectations. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'll answer the question this way. I think that school counselors are really very critical here to be able to work with teachers in identifying students who may have learning differences, which my hunch is going to be a lot of times that's what we're looking at when students are acting out consistently in class, that oftentimes they may not be grasping the material. So I think that is where the counselor, working with the teacher, working with the parent early on to identify what these deficits may be, and then figuring out does it make sense for that child to be in a special education situation, which among other things allows them to to take a test in, as an individual in the room, a standardized test. But it really requires, I think, at the school level, being able to be on top of that situation. I'm not saying it's going to be done in every case. I understand what the caller is talking about, but I do think with the combination of the counselor, principal, the parents, the teacher, we can do a better job identifying some of those and figuring out how to early on intervene.
I realize that, most public, I'll say all public school districts are, you know, limited financially in terms of what they're able to do, what they've been funded to do. But when we talk about solutions, and you mentioned earlier, you know, what happens between 9 and 4, do we need to start thinking more creatively? Like if somehow, you know, a particular campus or district, you know, consistently fails to make the kind of progress that we've decided is appropriate, do we need to say, how about an 11-month school year? How about, you know, a longer school day? How about a different approach than the one that we have essentially been taking to educating students, you know, since the 19th century?
Right. And so and part of that is under NCLB, if you're a consistently failing school, then after a series of steps, your last step is that school needs to be turned around and closed and reconstituted. So along that way of consistently failing, I guess, if you put it, there are opportunities for schools to go in and do what you're talking about, to figure out other strategies that may work. And here's where we can learn from the world of charters. So KIPP, I think a lot of people know that brand name, is one that does have longer school days. They break it up. It isn't like you're sitting at a desk the whole time. They're trying to engage students differently. Uplift here in Dallas, a group of, in North Texas, a group of charter schools also is experimenting with ways to reconstitute the day. So it's longer, but the kids are learning throughout that day in an innovative way. There's also ways we can look at making Saturday school a possibility, not where you're waving your finger at the kid, you know, that you've got to go to Saturday school. That's a detention, to make it a part of the learning process. And so there are a number of opportunities along the way with the right school leadership that you can go in and try to figure out what those strategies are.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Ed in Duncanville. Hello, Ed.
Howdy. I just couldn't believe that we were talking about, you know, it's just one test a year, and I don't know about the time. The way it worked in Irving when we taught there was we lost 6 weeks a year to testing because you literally shut the whole school down. And if you're delivering the test to the kids who failed last time, makeup test, you deliver the test to the kids who need a special English learning test. You deliver the test to the kids who pass and have to move on. And we're missing the kids who are doing great and should be treated as talented students. You're taking 6 weeks out. And then the final tests are done 5 to 6 weeks before the end of the year. We lose those weeks because there's nothing to teach then.
And I completely hear your frustration. And I guess maybe, Bill, you can talk about you are not actually advocating that we spend this much time testing.
No. And I don't know what he's talking about there. If the amount of time is being spent only for the STAR exam, or it could also be these benchmarks that we're talking about that districts give, and they aren't required to give them. They oftentimes give them to see if their students are on track. And at one level, I understand that. But again, I think that is what perhaps is adding to the testing volume. I don't perhaps know. I think it definitely adds to the testing volume. I would say, though, if you're having to spend as much time as he said getting ready for the test each year, then, in all due respect, then I think, you know, perhaps it's time to rethink some of the strategies you're using in the classroom to get students to see if they're on par with the state standards and where the state went. That could have to do with how the curriculum is aligned to the standards. We haven't talked about that, but the curriculum, needs to be aligned to the standards. So we aren't kind of going way over here and then at the very end having to rush back in to meet the state standards. he raised a point that, and I don't have the answer for it, but maybe that's one of the things we can do with technology. You know, if we take the standardized test at the end of the year, is there a way we can get this data back faster, you know, so schools can act upon it more quickly than the start of the next school year? I think that's something we should look into because we've got, so much improved technology. There could be a way to do that.
We have an email here from Brett in Louisville who writes, I believe No Child Left Behind and Common Core have excellent components to them. I also believe they both have flaws. That being said, how does the conversation move beyond what is wrong with each plan and to what is right with each plan?
What is right with Common Core and the other was what?
And NCLB.
Right. So here's what I think, to start with NCLB. Here's what I think was right about that, is what I've talked about earlier. It's about raising standards, measuring students against those standards and having some consequence. That's really important. The other part that's really important is taking this data and breaking it apart so you can see it in what's called subgroups, you know, race, income, gender, others, to see how students are performing. That's really important. Common Core. Texas doesn't have it, but a number of 46 states roughly do. And it is all about raising standards and trying to come up with a set of common assessments that we think are important, that students know meet these standards in these core areas.
Are you optimistic that testing will continue to be refined so that it works better? I mean, we do talk a lot, and you and I were talking in the break about, you know, the things that don't work, and sometimes the temptation is to throw the baby out with the bathwater. How do we ensure, if testing is going to continue, that we make it more accurate?
Right. So I think that's where your education researchers are consistently need to be part of this discussion to make sure we do have improved test over time. No question about that. Am I optimistic that testing will remain part of it? Yes, for this reason, is as you see it happening in Washington as they're reconsidering No Child Left Behind. And let me say, I think there are ways we should rewrite it and we should make improvements. And there's no argument about that. But you do see civil rights groups. I've mentioned this several times. You see business groups that are standing up and saying, well, wait a second. You know, maybe this doesn't really make sense to roll back annual independent tests in grades 3 through 8 and 10. So here's a historical analogy I've thought about. So when Ronald Reagan went to Reykjavik in the mid-1980s and talked to Gorbachev about having a nuclear-free world, everybody thought, oh, yeah, that's great. And it was like he threw up the window up on a nuclear-free world, and then people in both parties stood back and thought, that may not be such a great idea. I think that same thing is starting to happen with testing. People are starting to see there is value in this for the students. And if you don't have the data on the students and what they can help them improve, how are they going to get better?
William McKenzie is editorial director of the George W. Bush Institute. You can read his essay, The Big Idea of School Accountability, online at bushcenter.org. Bill, it's always a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.